Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Catherine DiNapoli, who is co-writer of the film Untitled. I'm very happy now to welcome Igor Volsky. He is a healthcare researcher. He's a blogger at the Center for American Progress, and we are having him on again to talk about health insurance reform. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So we are progressing as a nation in health insurance reform. The House and the Senate versions of the healthcare reform bills are now known. Is that right? Do we know what is in each one?
We do. The bills are available online for anyone to see. They can either go to my website, wongkroom.org, where I blog and talk about all the details and compare and contrast the bills, or they could, of course, go to the Senate and House website to get the full thousands and thousands of pages and read through the legislation. There's also a lot of helpful outlines and guides to the bills. So all this is available. You know, we've been talking about it for more than a year now. All of these details, all these specifics, the bills have been through markup and numerous committees in Congress. And now, of course, the House passed its version 2 weeks ago. Now it's the Senate's turn. So it's kind of a very exciting time for healthcare reform. And hopefully we can get something done by the end of the year, if not early next year.
So let's talk about these two bills, starting with the public option. I find it fascinating that there have been so many times that the media have said the public option is dead and the people have spoken up and it's not dead. What, at this point, is the public option in each of these bills?
Well, the public option is probably the most popular aspect of healthcare reform, and that's, of course, a government-run insurance plan that individuals can choose on a level playing field with other private insurers. A couple of months ago, we were talking about a public option as this real robust plan that is able to use Medicare's market power to negotiate lower rates with providers and to lower premiums for Americans and to reduce premiums by about 10% on average and save the government some $150 billion. Well, since that time, the plan has been weakened, some would say significantly, but it's still alive. So in the current legislation, in the House bill, you have a real national public plan that negotiates rates independently with providers, which means it saves less money than if it used Medicare rates. And it would attract about 6 million enrollees, according to the Congressional Budget Office, which analyzes these things. In the Senate, you have something a little different. You have a public option that states could opt out of by 2014, so they could pass a law on the state level saying, we don't want to be part of this. And it's estimated that about 17 states would do this. And that kind of option would attract about 3 to 4 million new enrollees. Now, both of these plans are relatively small, and so they're not going to have the kind of impact on health insurance markets, the kind of impact on premiums that we would like to see. But what they do is they kind of get our foot in the door of building a healthcare system that isn't geared around profit and making investors happy, but built around really providing people with quality healthcare. So it gets our foot in the door, and it allows reformers down the road to kind of build up. And many also think that the kind of estimates that you're hearing, the ones I just quoted, really are conservative numbers, that if the public option is really good at keeping its costs down, if it's really good at providing efficient care, at having lower administrative spending than private counterparts, then it could really attract more enrollees. So time would tell, and I think, you know, this is a decent starting point. It's certainly better than not having public option at all.
There has been some controversy over who would even be allowed to sign up for the public option in the first place. Where does that stand?
There is a lot of controversy. Senator Ron Wyden, who's the senator from Oregon, has something called the Choices Amendment. In the current legislation, for the first 2 to 3 years, the only people who are eligible for any kind of insurance plan in the new exchanges, and of course in the exchanges you have the public option and private insurers, the only people eligible for those plans are small businesses, the self-employed, and people who currently receive coverage in what's called the individual market. Eventually, after 2 to 3 years, those exchanges open up to larger employers and larger employers. And by around 2017, 2018, everyone who wants to can join these exchanges and could then, of course, enroll in the public option. What Ron Wyden would do, Senator Wyden, is he would blow that timeline up and say from day one when the exchanges come into being, which varies from about 2013 to 2014 in the different bills, that anyone who wants to can come up into the exchange and sign up, and of course sign up for the public option if that's what they choose. Of course, you know, some reformers fear that health reform is hard to pass, but it's even harder to implement, and that you kind of need time to make sure all the structures work correctly, and you want to start small initially and build up to ensure kind of a smooth transition, because this hasn't really been tried before on a national level, which is why we have these kinds of timelines. And we also want to ensure that people have continual access to care so that there are no gaps in coverage, because in healthcare, if you have a gap, oftentimes there's really horrible consequences. People die and so on and so forth. For instance, when Medicare Part D was first implemented, there were a lot of gaps in coverage, and some people had, you know, disaster stories about they couldn't get their medications filled on time. So we want to avoid those kinds of problems with health reform, and to ensure that the system that is established is done so and rolled out over time so that people and providers and payers have a real chance to get used to it.
When you say it's brand new and hasn't been tried before, what about Medicare, which is already completely in place? I mean, wouldn't the public option be just like adding more people to Medicare on some level?
Well, I didn't mean to imply that we're kind of out in the woods on reform. We're not. We're building on the current system. As you mentioned, Medicare, certainly, and a public option would be modeled in some ways on Medicare. That's absolutely true. And, of course, Massachusetts adopted very similar reforms to what we're now doing on the national level back in 2003. So there are certainly, you know, there are templates for this, but it has never really been implemented on a national level. And healthcare is often very local in the United States, all about states and state regulations. So, you know, these ideas are out there, these ideas are tried, but when it comes to actually establishing the infrastructure, I'm suggesting that that part of implementation will take some time.
Let's talk about these exchanges that you are mentioning. What are exchanges? What do they look like? What are they to the consumer, the big business, the small business, the individual?
You know, I've been surprised that one of the kind of least understood areas of healthcare reform are these exchanges. I always thought it was the public option or payment reform or something, but a lot of people have questions about exchanges, and it's important to kind of lay it out and explain it correctly, because they're one of the main mechanisms through which coverage is expanded. An exchange in some ways is like an Orbitz for health insurance. So you would log on to your computer and go to the exchange website, for instance, or you would go to their offices in your local area, and you would say, here's my profile. I'm an individual. I'm so and so, I have these kinds of conditions. I'm this old. What would be the best plan for me? And that means which plan would provide me with the greatest benefits for my needs. And an exchange would help you, would pair you up and help you find a product that's suitable for you. Within that exchange, you would have a set of private insurers and a public option competing for your business and competing to offer you health benefits. The legislation requires every insurance plan that wants to participate in the exchange to offer a minimum standard of benefits. So they would be offering the basic needs, maternity care, basic primary care services, and they would be competing on quality, on delivering those services most efficiently, because no longer would they be able to discriminate against someone because of a pre-existing condition, or they wouldn't be able to rescind somebody's coverage because a claim came in that they didn't agree with. So it's those kinds of reforms that you often hear people talk about. They are targeted towards mainly the exchange. They also occur outside of the exchange, but mainly in the exchange where somebody comes in and an exchange really pairs them up with a policy and also regulates the policies that are in the exchange. You know, these provisions are somewhat controversial, and when the bill comes to the floor, they'll certainly be debated and amended, but there are some ideas out there, and this is what Massachusetts does, is that it also has an exchange, but what their exchange does is it weeds out inefficient plans and only allows those plans that can provide quality services efficiently with very low administrative overhead to compete for business within the exchange. A lot of reformers want to see the same thing happen on the national level. Right now, that's not really in the bills, or at least not yet. Senator Kerry from Massachusetts has offered amendments to kind of make exchanges prudent purchasers of health care so that they only allow insurers that are efficient to take part in these exchanges, because that could really lower costs. So there are a lot of parts to this, but I think the simplest way to think about it is really kind of an orbit for exchanges where people go in and they choose which policy works for them.
What constitutes efficiency?
Well, efficiency is how much of many factors. So, for instance, what kind of contract that plan has with a provider, how much they reimburse that provider, hospital, or doctor for a given medical service, how efficiently the plan can process a claim, how many people work in its bill processing department, for instance, do they have standardized forms, so on and so forth, so that the overhead that insurers have is lower. If you can lower that overhead, then you can ensure that the healthcare premiums that you pay into that insurance policy, that most of them, the great majority of them, more than 90% of them, go towards paying your bills, not towards profits and administrative spending.
One of the complaints that I've heard about the system as it exists now, besides the absolute horror stories of people not being able to get insurance or having real illnesses not be covered and being dropped and all of these things that we've heard a lot about, from the point of view of the doctor's offices and the hospitals, the bureaucratic nightmare is immense. Every insurance company has different forms. They have to have a million different ways of paying. It's impossible to... I've been through this myself. It is impossible to figure out how much a blood test costs, for example, because of this morass. Would health insurance reform make a dent in any of that?
It would, and it's that kind of morass, as you describe it, that contributes so much to the amount of money we waste on healthcare, dealing with all these bureaucracies, dealing with the different codes for how much this procedure is, how much that procedure is. And what health reform would do is it would establish standards so that a single form is used for certain things, not 10 different forms, so that it requires, for instance, the House bill requires hospitals to post the price of all of their procedures online, so that's more readily available and more readily known to people. So it has a lot of good provisions to strengthen the transparency, to improve efficiency in that way, in the sense of getting rid of needless paperwork. And, of course, if you have everybody going into these exchanges, that in itself would streamline some of the efficiencies, because plans would be using the documentation from the exchange, not kind of their own, you know, their own independent paperwork for each company. And also, I should note, because we're regulating insurers for the first time, you know, telling them, for instance, they can't underwrite a policy based on somebody's health experiences, and these are pre-existing conditions, so on and so forth, all of those departments that they keep just for underwriting would largely be eliminated. So that, too, should save money.
So all of those people trying to figure out reasons not to pay your claim, those would just go down the tubes.
That's right. Well, claim denials will exist. These bills don't outlaw claim denials. Claim denials are seen as a way of managing how much money is spent on health care, to ensure that kind of exorbitant claim denials, people who go to the doctor every other day, that's managed in some way. The rescissions and pre-existing conditions, those are outlawed.
We're talking to Igor Volsky from the Center for American Progress. What about unemployed and laid off workers and people who've never had insurance before? How are they covered under health insurance reform?
They would go into the exchanges where they would find a policy that works for them.
So you have your policy through your company, which is found in the exchange, whatever. You're laid off. What do you do? What happens next? Is your coverage continuous? You know, and those are the people who have the least amount of money to spend, of course, on health insurance.
Right. Well, if you just lost your job, you also lost your health insurance policy. So now you become uninsured. As someone who's uninsured, you're eligible for coverage either through the exchange when it becomes operational in 2013 or 2014, or you can go find coverage in the individual market. It's probably cheaper for you to find coverage in the exchange if you're a lower-income American, because you will receive affordability credits to help you afford and purchase this coverage. So you would have options within the exchange, and you choose the plan that works for you. But you're immediately eligible as soon as you lose your job and you lose your health insurance coverage from your employer for affordable coverage options in the exchange.
One line in one of the articles that you wrote was the following, and it's quite staggering. $800 billion a year is spent on health procedures that actually worsen health outcomes. What's this all about? And does health insurance reform address any of that?
You know, there's a lot of waste in our system, a lot of overtreatment in our system. A lot of tests are performed that don't really improve health outcomes. A lot of procedures that don't improve health outcomes. And in fact, as you mentioned, worsen them. And one of the ways health reform tackles this is through something called comparative effectiveness research, where researchers go in and try to figure out, is drug A better than drug B? Because we simply don't know. There are many procedures and drugs out there that treat the same condition, and tests aren't conducted from an unbiased source about which works better. And so what health reform would do is it would fund that kind of research, and it would allow the relevant agencies, the relevant board that does this kind of work, to then put out guidelines for providers to follow if they choose, guidelines that will inform them which treatment, which drug is most effective. It should be noted, however, that these kinds of guidelines are just one piece of data for doctors to use. They must also consider the unique circumstances of the patient when deciding which course of treatment to take. So these are just recommendations that providers would follow. But realistically speaking, if it's discovered that a popular treatment does nothing to improve health outcomes, then doctors, most of them, of course, are in the job or doing the job to help their patients, will stop prescribing that kind of treatment, that ineffective treatment, and that would lower healthcare expenditures.
The way medicine is structured right now is doctors are reimbursed by insurance companies on a fee-for-service basis, and so there is, no matter how ethical they are, just built into the system, there is a motivation to do more tests, to perform more services, you get more fees. Is there, in health insurance reform, anywhere a motivation to really keep patients healthy and require the least number of interventions and treatments?
Well, you get to the question that really speaks to the culture of medicine in America. And as you point out, doctors at this point are used to being reimbursed for every single procedure that they perform, not for keeping their patient healthy. And that's a very key distinction. And so if I'm a doctor, I am paid more to assign my patient five different tests than to sit for 30 minutes and to listen to my patient so I get a fuller understanding of their symptoms and discuss with them which treatment course they would want to pursue. And it's that kind of system of broken incentives that not only contributes to our out-of-control spending on healthcare, but also worsens healthcare outcomes, because I'm sure you know that in this country, as compared to others around the world, we spend the most and we don't get better outcomes for it. And part of the reason is the way we pay providers and the kind of incentives we have in place. What health reform would do through Medicare, because again, that's what the government controls, Medicare, Medicaid, is it would establish demonstration projects that begin paying providers differently. So for example, rather than paying for all the treatments associated with treating, arthritis, for instance, what health reform would do is it would pay a single capitated rate for treating that kind of arthritis, and that would encourage the doctor to then try to treat that condition in the most efficient kind of way. Now, of course, those payments would be tied to quality, so that a provider couldn't get away with not actually improving the health outcome. He would have to. But he would also be encouraged to actually treat the condition, not just provide and prescribe as many treatments as possible for it. And so if those projects work, then they'll be expanded and they'll be adopted by Medicare. And we know historically that if Medicare changes the way it pays providers or changes the way it does something, then private insurers tend to follow suit. I should also note that there are areas in this country, there are clinics like the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, that have already adopted those kinds of payment reforms, bundled payments, as they're called. And those kinds of clinics, the president talks about this an awful lot, have been successful not only in lowering costs, which is important, but much more importantly, they've been successful in improving health outcomes. And many patients go to the Cleveland Clinic and get some of the best care on earth, quality care that's delivered very efficiently.
The last time you and I spoke, you explained very clearly what the insurance company lobbying strategy was, and that was they wanted to have mandated insurance, and they wanted there to be no public option so that that mandated insurance, 300 million Americans, would have to pay into private insurance companies. What is there? I mean, the public option is now... if this all passes, we're going to have one of some kind. What's the health insurance lobbying strategy at this point?
It hasn't changed. I don't remember when exactly we spoke last, but I think maybe since then, we've heard from Wendell Potter, who has been all over the media by this point. He has testified to Congress. He used to be a chief vice president, I think, of communications in Cigna. He has since retired and defected, if you will, and I had a chance to sit down with him, and he really explained in some detail what the new health insurance strategy is. Publicly, these are two-prong attacks. Publicly, the health insurers go on television in the form of Karen Ignani, who is the chief lobbyist of insurers, an organization called AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And they tell you that they really want reform, and they've put together this plan of their own that, as you point out, would require everyone to purchase coverage, private insurance coverage. It wouldn't have any kind of new competition from a public plan. And they also encourage policymakers to expand Medicaid, which they do, actually, to take in all the sick and poor people so that they're left with a market that's relatively profitable. That's one prong. That's the public campaign.
I would just say, in terms of the public campaign, it's really an overt strategy to move taxpayer money into their pockets because, of course, the mandatory coverage would have to be subsidized for lower-income people.
That's right, and they're very clear about the fact that they want government subsidies. In fact, I should note that Within healthcare reform, there's something called modified rating, which allows insurers to charge older people more than younger people. It's something called modified community rating. And different bills have different ratios. So the most liberal health reform we've seen says that insurers shouldn't be able to charge older people more than twice that what they charge younger people. It's called a ratio of 2-to-1, and it's one that's accepted by most health economists as a reasonable ratio to kind of spread risk and costs appropriately across a given population. The health insurers, however, are lobbying to establish a risk ratio for age of 5-to-1. So they want to charge older people 5 times as much as younger people. And they recognize that this creates serious affordability issues for older Americans, that their coverage will be far more expensive. And it also requires the government to subsidize them a lot higher if coverage, if premiums are that much higher. So what they propose, and this gets to the point of they don't mind spending the government's money and taking it and putting it into their pockets, they propose under a 5-to-1 modified age rating ratio, a separate premium subsidy program for older Americans. So outside of the subsidies we're already paying, they want to have a whole other kind of subsidy for older Americans so that, they can afford their preferred age rate ratio. So they're very blatant about taking government money and putting it into their pockets.
You know, one of the ironies when I listen to you talk about that is the Americans who are for having more limited government and lower taxes would, by definition, have to be against that. Because if you accept the health insurance proposal, you have to tax your citizens more.
Well, that's right. And, of course, there you see the gap between the purist ideology and the political reality. The political reality is you find ways to put that money not into social programs if you're a Republican, but into corporate coffers. And one of the ways this is done in healthcare reform is by trying to defeat a public option, because a public option wouldn't only lower premiums for Americans, but it would also force the government, or allow the government, rather, to spend less on subsidies, because the way subsidies are calculated is by using the two or the three lowest plans in the exchange, the lowest premiums in the exchange. It's calculated that way. So obviously, if you have a public option that offers the lowest premiums, the amount of subsidies that the government pays will be lower. So you're right. If they were true to their ideology and spending less government money, they would be more than willing to adopt a public option that's fully financed by premiums, and that's key also.
So in health care reform, as it's written, which ratio are they using?
In the bills now, in the Senate, the age ratio is 3-to-1, so insurers wouldn't be able to charge older people more than 3 times the price of the policy that they charge to younger people. In the House, I think the ratio is about the same. Also, it's about 3-to-1, maybe a little lower.
So the insurance companies have been able to exert some pressure, but not as much as they want.
That's right.
We were talking about all Americans being mandated to buy insurance, but then when I actually read about this, the numbers are that we wouldn't even be close in 10 years to having universal coverage. We would have 90% of Americans covered 10 years from now, so that means 18 million people, if the population doesn't grow at all, are still without insurance coverage. Why is that?
Well, it's about 94-96%, depending on the plan. Part of it is because of course, our political problem that we have with undocumented immigrants. The bill does not apply to them, and they would remain uninsured. The other part are Americans who will simply refuse to purchase coverage, and these are individuals who will pay the penalty and won't purchase coverage, and very little can be done about them. There's always be a small group who don't want to purchase coverage, who think that they won't get sick. And another group of Americans are Americans who still won't be able to afford coverage, even with all these reforms. That's, of course, a very small group. So you add that together, and you get about, 6% of the population that will remain uninsured.
To what extent is the White House and President Obama weighing in on this issue?
Well, we saw during the summer, of course, the president held numerous town halls and went to colleges and universities across America to kind of champion reform. And now he's taken a quieter approach. Hopefully he's making behind-the-scenes phone calls, calling senators and congresspeople and urging them to vote for the bill. I hope he's doing that. I'm sure he is, in fact. But he's taken a back seat these last few months and has let really Congress, since they'll be passing the bill, has let Congress take the lead in shaping the legislation and in pushing it through Congress. I should note that all of the legislation that we've seen, of course, reflects the president's principles, the same principles he laid out during the campaign. He's just not sitting there and deciding specifically what the premium rates should be, what the affordability standards should be, all those details he's leaving to Congress.
The legislation will, according to current estimates, reduce the deficit of our country by $130 billion over the next decade. How does it do that?
Well, like this. So in the Senate bill, you're right, it reduces the deficit by about $130 billion over 10 years. It does this in several ways. First, it pays for the coverage expansion, which is about $848 billion, and it has money left over. So it raises money in various ways. It imposes a excise tax, a 40% tax on insurers who provide what's called Cadillac health care plans. These are plans that are lavish, that contribute to some of the overutilization and overspending and the waste in the healthcare system that we've discussed. So part of that tax, it will generate more money than the cost of the coverage expansion, and so any difference will be reinvested back into reducing the deficit. You have a new payroll tax in the Senate bill, which increases the payroll tax for employees who earn more than $250,000. Again, you combine all that together, and if there's some leftover, that goes towards deficit reduction. You have cuts in Medicare spending. These aren't benefit cuts. These are cuts that take out some of the waste and inefficiencies in the system. That generates money. So if you add all of that up, and also, of course, the fees that the government's going to collect from the penalties that certain individuals and employers will pay for not buying or offering coverage, you combine all of that, and you have enough to pay for reform, which is the 848, plus more money left over, and that money that's left over should go towards reducing the deficit.
To what extent is there also an emphasis on prevention? And of course, when you do prevention, it's hard to run the numbers, but in theory, prevention could also save huge amounts of money that then doesn't get spent on, for example, diabetes treatment and things like that.
Right. Theoretically, if we catch these chronic conditions in which we spend about 80% of our healthcare dollars, we can stop them before they become a problem, treat them more simply when they're in their early stages, and save a lot of money down the road. The problem is those savings are down the road. And when I say down the road, I mean 20, 30, 40 years. And so the Congressional Budget Office won't touch them, won't score them. Also, some prevention is more expensive than treating the condition. That's also true. Part of the reason is because, and this is gruesome, but this is the way economics works in some respects, that if you give somebody a lot of preventive care, they're going to live longer. And if they live longer, they will be a larger burden on society. Again, we don't like to think of it in those terms, but you know, in some respects, that's how the budget office calculates these risks. And so, long story short, they don't score prevention very well. And so the bill still, though, however, does invest in prevention. It's lower in the Senate than it is in the House. It's about, $34 billion on a wellness fund that's in the House bill and about $16 billion in a wellness fund that's in the Senate bill. And so that should begin to invest not only in research, but also in things like vaccines for the population. Also, you have provisions that, as part of the minimum benefit package that we've discussed earlier, insurers would have to offer preventive services without any cost sharing attached to it. So if I'm going for my yearly physical, I'm not going to be paying any kind of copay in the doctor's office. And that's thought to encourage people to go to the doctor more often for their preventive services. And that should also, you know, kind of catch some of these chronic conditions before they become too serious and, of course, too expensive to treat.
What should citizens be doing right now?
Well, of course, there's a whole host of wellness things Americans can do. We can exercise more. We know obesity is a problem. We can eat better. We don't eat very well. Taking care of one's body, I think, will do a lot more if we all as a population took this kind of approach. It would go a lot further in reducing healthcare spending over the long term than any government mandates or any kind of government legislation or expansion would. But of course, changing that kind of behavior, changing the culture and shifting it towards wellness is a serious effort and one that I don't know how many Americans would individually do. I do know that the president, however, during the Super Bowl is filming some kind of commercial where he's encouraging wellness and going outside and tossing around a football with football players. And so he's doing a PSA there. But, you know, of course, obviously, if we were more cognizant of our health, we would have a lot less health expenditures.
And in terms of health insurance reform and seeing that it passes, are you still encouraging people to make those phone calls and whatnot?
Well, you know, certainly pressuring elected officials to vote for health reform doesn't hurt. When they hear from their constituents in large numbers, they very, very often change their or at least think more seriously about voting for reform. I would encourage everyone to call moderate Democrats. We know Republicans won't vote for this bill. It's ideological and political, but moderate Democrats like Senator Landrieu, Senator Lincoln, Senator Bayh, Senator Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut, and to pressure them to vote for health care reform. This is the most important vote they will cast, I think, in their lifetime for many of them, and they should vote yes. They should vote the right way.
Igor Volsky is healthcare researcher and blogger at the Center for American Progress, which is at americanprogress.org. And his many, many fine articles on the subject can be found at wonkroom.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm happy now to welcome Catherine DiNapoli. She is co-writer and producer of the film Untitled, which is screening at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
So this is a very interesting film about a successful painter, his extremely unsuccessful brother, who's kind of a tortured composer, and a young, beautiful New York gallery owner who gives them both various kinds of opportunities. And it's a kind of a satire of an art world that's driven by language and concepts that sometimes seem like total bull, but it's not totally satire either. What was your motivation for writing this film?
Well, we really enjoy going to galleries and are kind of a part of the art scene a little bit. Jonathan, the director's son, actually studied art at NYU, and his parents are art collectors. And I myself am somewhat of an artist, so just a really, kind of a fun subject for us. And also we went to some new music concerts that were very similar to the first concert in the film. So that was kind of the inspiration for that. And they actually played one of David Lang's pieces. David Lang was our composer. And there were three people standing on stage. There was a clarinetist in the middle making these guttural noises and these two huge drums on either side. So anyway, we wanted to kind of marry those two subjects.
It is interesting that if you're going to make a film, a narrative film, full of fictitious contemporary art and music, you have to have an artist and a composer helping you. I mean, how did you approach that task?
Well, we wanted all of the art to have, you know, integrity, even though it was, you know, art that was fictional, and the music as well. Kyle Ng did a lot of the taxidermy art, And he's a young guy, like 22 years old, this artist from L.A. And I had met him and thought, we thought he would be a really great guy to make some of the work. And when we visited his house, he had all of this taxidermy everywhere, and he was really into doing taxidermy art. And then he even took us on a studio visit to this garage where there was this guy was doing taxidermy work, and these dogs would come by from the neighborhood and bark. And anyway, it was just kind of a like Silence of the Lambs scene. It was pretty interesting. So Kyle did a lot of the art, and then Jonathan's son, who's studying at NYU, came up with some of the concepts that then Kyle actually made. And then as far as the music goes, David Lang is our composer. He actually won the Pulitzer Prize last year. He's just a really amazing composer. And the director, Jonathan Parker, knew David from his days at Stanford. And David, we had asked to just do the score, but he actually had a lot of fun doing, you know, kind of the other music as well, the kind of crazy pouring water, bucket kicking type music. So we also are releasing the soundtrack, which I think is a really great album.
I mean, it is hilarious. You know, the guy, you're sitting there and this watching the film, and there's a tiny audience of people watching a man very seriously put a chain into a bucket and then kick the bucket. And, you know, and you're watching and going, you know, can anybody take this seriously? And what about you as the filmmakers? I mean, to what extent did you say this is laughable versus this is really serious and to be taken seriously?
Well, that's what's so funny about it. When you go to a new music concert, the people there do take it extremely seriously. The musicians and the people in the audience, who many times are you know, composers themselves or of that genre. And to us, it was very funny, but to have, you know, to laugh at such a performance would be unheard of. So anyway, yeah, we very much love the music, but there is a comic aspect as well.
As I was watching it, I felt like the comic aspect boiled down to basically a pretty strong critique of the followers of John Cage, if not John Cage himself. What is your own relationship to, or your feeling about that aesthetic of, for example, having a piece which has no sound at all and just listening to the sounds in the room, or having the sounds be made by the most pedestrian objects?
Well, I mean, going back to the days of studying classical music, I remember a girl at a piano recital doing just that. So definitely, you know, it's a concept.
So it also, I mean, again, it's funny because just a few days ago we had on the air three musicians who are local sound artists who do all sorts of things with computers. And I asked them the same thing that I wanted to ask you, which is, there's a kind of art cliche that goes like this: if you don't understand my work, that means it's way ahead of its time, just like the people didn't understand the Impressionists or Stravinsky in their time, which of course anybody can say, no matter how good or bad their work is. And how do you feel about the avant-garde as it exists today? Is it analogous to that time 100 years ago when people were stomping out of the theater?
Well, it's a question: will time ever catch up? If you're ahead of its time, will it catch up? You know, I very much enjoy avant-garde music, and I'm sure I would have enjoyed it 100 years ago as well. But I do think David Lang is coming up with some very, very new concepts too. As far as presenting it in a film, you know, you kind of have to, just so everybody gets it, in a way, you kind of need to make it something that everyone can relate to rather than some kind of, you know, total minutia that no one's ever heard of. So I think going back to the silent concert, which may have been something that was done a long time ago, I think people can relate to that. If you do something that's just so weird, sometimes it's too weird and people might not be able to kind of relate to that.
There are wonderful actors in the film, Marley Shelton and Adam Goldberg. And how did you, what was the process of casting this film?
So this film is a low budget film, and Basically, in the beginning, I was just writing offers and calling agents and making firm offers. And basically what happens is we don't audition kind of name actors. They just have to really relate to the script and want to do it because they're not getting paid a ton of money. So Adam Goldberg was the first person we thought of for the role of Adrian Jacobs, and he just loved the script, and he was the first person to come on board. And once we had Adam attached, things got easier. He actually recommended that we get Marley Shelton, and that just kind of made it a viable project when you have an actor attached. Later on, we got a really great casting director on board, Diana Brigitte, and she helped get a lot of the other cast.
Adam Goldberg plays the brooding and tortured artist so beautifully. I don't think the scowl ever leaves his face practically the whole movie.
Yeah, I remember just going through these, you know, pictures that are on IMDb online trying to figure out who to cast. And he had this just scowl from all these photos that he was doing press for us if he had a bad day or what, but it was just really great and it totally fit the character. So that was actually a big help in casting.
How do you go about doing a low budget film of this nature? I mean, it certainly had excellent production values.
Yeah, we really tried to get as much value as we could out of every single dollar. I made sure on this production to sign every single check, and we really, you know, kind of managed it carefully. And then we had some private investors. I think that's the only way that a film like this will get made, because it is so kind of the opposite of what a studio would fund. It's definitely not exactly a, you know, genre picture.
Have you gotten much response to it yet? Has it opened in New York?
Oh, yeah. We've gotten really great reviews, and the New York Times, the LA Times, Ebert, and we opened it at the Angelica in New York, and we opened in LA, and now I think it's moved to the Beverly Center in LA, and San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago. So we're having some really great response. We're pleased.
Have you talked to or heard the response from any gallery owners and artists and musicians who have seen it? I mean, there is some kind of looking in the mirror that must happen when certain people see this film.
Yeah, for the most part, the artists really love it, and I think they can kind of laugh at themselves. And the couple of gallery owners that we're friends with really like it in L.A., and I'm sure that some people, you know, take their work seriously and think that we are, you know, maybe making fun of it. But I'm hoping that people can kind of see it with a comic light. We played at the Carmel Film Festival, and there were all these artists there, and they just seemed really genuinely moved. So that was kind of cool.
Catherine DiNapoli is the co-writer and producer of the film Untitled, which is screening at the CCA here in Santa Fe. And you can find more about that from ccasantafe.org or call 505-982-1338. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're going to play a little clip from the film.
So what'd you think?
It's young, forward, drinkable.
About the concert.
I like a melody.
Can't you give us any meaningful feedback?
All right. Why don't you try composing something with more emotion?
Why?
So you can find an audience.
And how big should my audience be, Josh? One, 10, a million? Is a million enough?
Is the marketplace the measure of our culture?
That would mean the death of all thought.
Lighten up, Adrian.
Lightening up is not an emotion.
Josh has a point. Sometimes you hide behind intellectual mannerisms.
I mean, this is not popular music. Why does everybody think they're an expert? It's like hearing a lecture on nuclear physics and saying, like, nah, I didn't really like it.
I'm still shaking from the bucket kicks. They cut straight through me. Is it a death knell? A call to manual labor? Add the clarinet overtones and it's a striking effect. The chain drop. Human passion unchained. The kind that takes us right to the edge.
Got a good woman there, Joshy.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And you can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Colors of Jazz.